Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
How you be? How are you doing?
Oh, you know, we're into the, 53rd week of 2020?
Right. Yes, 53rd, 54th. Somebody wrote it's like December 37th or something.
Yes, December 37th.
2020. Yeah. Wow. It's been interesting the last week, obviously, with everything happening at the Capitol building and, you know, the sudden collapse of society.
the sudden steady rise of
right, exactly. Yeah. The slow and steady collapse. And it's so funny, dear listener, we had actually plotted this series. So today is the first. We're going to do the Purge film series. We thought that'd be fun for January, you know, the election year, the inauguration. We thought it would be a good idea to chat about these films, and we didn't realize how prescient that would be. So it should be an interesting couple of weeks as we apply what I thought would sort of be a kind of a historical analysis of the Purge series is now becoming very, very, very current.
As is with a lot of horror, right? Horror as Oracle.
Right. There we go.
This, I think, is the first time that we're doing a full franchise, right?
I don't think we've actually ever done that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is kind of playing a couple of different roles because obviously we wanted to talk about politics and sort of this rise in violence and, you know, yes, the the clairvoyance, I guess, of the Purge, but also we're going to be doing a focus in February on particularly on black horror and things discussed in horror noir. And so this also seemed like a really good way to bridge that conversation through the film series with the Purge, because there's such a focus and conversation on race and economic politics. So mm-hmm. I just thought this, you know, we kind of plotted this out as like this, oh, this should be a lot of fun. And now it's like, well, we'll see how this goes over the next few weeks.
Yeah.
We may have to pull episodes or pause on them until, you know, depending on what inauguration day looks like. But for now, that is what we're going to be discussing over the next couple of weeks. So you now have, you've got, dear listener, time to watch and get caught up on the Purge series if you haven't watched all of them. But first, Jew, what's been going on otherwise? What are some good things happening to you before we dive into the horror?
I mean, you know, we didn't talk about this last week, but Drag Race is back.
Right? Drag Race
is back. Drag Race original recipe, right?
Drag Race original recipe. No. That's
hilarious. Drag Race original co-opted recipe is back. Which is interesting to see because I haven't done much research in it, but you can tell that they filmed this in the Corona times, pandemic times. It's produced a very interesting premise. I think we're at a point now where I think we're just going to see a lot of stunts shows and shenanigans.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is keeping it fresh and new. And I got to say, you know, shout out to all of the queens who have been trying to make it this last year, because, you know, the drag sort of like ecosystem, the industrial drag, the drag industrial complex is kind of predicated on like travel and being in rooms with people and community and, you know, all of these things. And so with some of our favorite queens, it's like they've had to pivot very like pivot very quickly to remote work to be remote queens and, you know, Cameo and all that stuff. So it's nice to kind of see them back on screen. And also it's nice to just have, you know, something to look forward to again every week.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's we watched, I think we're on, what is it, 2 episodes so far. Mm-hmm. I always get annoyed when it gets too, like, that whole stunt with the pork chop and separating them out, and then it's like, you're voted out. Oh, no, you're not really voted out. Now you're just going to be in the other group. I just find that just kind of offensive and wasting time. It's like, this season is going to be 30 episodes long. You know, or if they've had to separate them into 2 separate teams. I don't know. It's just some of it. I was just a little annoyed at that because I don't like that sort of emotional manipulation for really no reason. I mean, if they'd really sent her home and she really wasn't going to compete, I don't want to say who she is just in case our, you know, listeners getting caught up if you're a Drag Race fan. But I was just like, if they'd actually sent her home, then fine. I'd buy into the thing. Like, sorry, girl. Like, that was the rule. Out, you know, like, sorry you got fucked, but at least you got a few minutes on television. Hopefully you sold yourself enough for people to, you know, want to follow you on the social media and invest in your drag and your art. But instead of it being like, instead they were like, now you're back. So it just feels manipulative in a way that wasn't entertaining to me.
Yeah,
but anyways, that's just that part. Otherwise, I mean, it was very fun. Again, because Drag Race has been on for so long, we're now seeing, like, you know, this generation of queens raised on Drag Race, and they're coming super prepared and pretty talented. They look, you know, amazing and have amazing clothing right from the start. You know, you're not seeing that same, you know, kind of mix of high and low. I feel like everybody's coming in and with a pretty good look, you know.
And yeah, I'm yeah, and those are things that, like, again, that's, those are things that money can control. Totally. I mean, then a shout out to the late great Chichi Devane, who, you know, said it right from, who said it in her season, it's just like, I am a queen from here, I don't have access in the same way that y'all have access to certain things. And and I think that really kind of blew, I don't want to say blew the lid off of it, but, you know, it was kind of like, and it was a calling attention to, like, you know, what, you know, more established queens have access, have, you know, connections, the younger queens, you know, depending on whatever background they come from. And so, so it's going to be interesting to see, as, you know, these last couple seasons where you had, like you said, you have the crop of queens raised on Drag Race or who did drag inspired, you know, who are doing drag because of Drag Race, to see what happens and to see where still some of the where some of the missteps are occurring.
Of course.
Or the thing, you know, because I'm sure we're going to get a I'm sure we're going to get a snatch game where someone's not prepared. And it's like, how can you not be prepared? You knew you were going to be on the show. No, but we'll see. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, how it lays out. But it's just interesting to see kind of at the beginning where it's like, everybody's pretty good, you know? And it's not like, I have a harder time each year picking the ones that I'm immediately like, well, not you. You know, this one, I thought overall, like, there were some really good, good queens, you know, having a good time and doing pretty well. Even the ones that were like, I'm new to performance, still did well for being new to performance, you know? So
yeah,
that's another thing. And I've heard, like, older queens, like, I was just listening to an Ask Me Anything with Jackie Beat on Instagram. And she was saying, somebody asked her who some underrated queens are. And she's like, I hate that question. Instead, I would encourage, and I agree with this, I would encourage you to know your drag history. You know who Lady Bunny is, know who Coco Peru is, know who Varla Jean Merman is, know who, you know, Heclina, Lip Synca, you know, these, the queens that you saw in movies like Wigstock, which I think you can find on YouTube for free. Mm-hmm.
Will we count Alexis in that? Alexis Arquette?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, because in Wigstock, Alexis is at least presenting at that time as a drag queen, but I don't know. And Jackie kind of touched on that too. It's like back in the day in the '80s and '90s, trans women and drag queens were very close and they supported each other because they saw that the attacks on them are coming from that same place. Like we've talked about misogyny and homophobia, you know, coming the violence perpetrated is coming from this same demonization or dehumanization of women.
And the call is coming from inside the house. Yeah.
But just this idea of, you know, attack on feminine things. Mm-hmm. On the idea of femininity, you know, so she, but I don't know. I don't know too much about Alexis Arquette's, how she saw herself then.
True. Know? Yes.
But regardless, the people who really like were out saying they were drag queens are like, you know, like Jackie B and like Coco Peru and these sorts of, you know, so that's kind of what she said about, you know, who, like just that, you know, answering who was underrated. I can't remember how we got onto this subject now. What was the point I was trying to make? Whatever, who cares? just, I guess.
Well, you were talking about how, like, we were talking about how, like, you know, there's drag queens, who are, you're talking about underrated queens, and you brought up Jackie Beat. I actually don't know either. I'm just
spitballing. Oh, no, it was the performance part. Thing. Okay, that's
yes, what yes, yes, so yes. Was there we go.
Talking about like who's underrated, and she was like, at the end of the day, I just want people who can perform and who understand the history of drag, and that it's not always about being the prettiest. And you know, she gets that that's a thing, which I also agree. But I kind of tend to side with this idea that I'm not going to pay to see somebody who looks pretty in a club. You know, I'm not going to pay to see that show. I want to see somebody who sings, who dances, who's a comedian, who does, you know, like Coco Peru does these sort of one-woman shows. Jackie Beat, you know, writes parody songs and sings live. Varla Jean sings live. Lady Bunny does her DJ thing. She's also a comedian, you know. So there's like something more to invest in than just looking pretty. It's not enough.
Yeah.
And so I still think that that is one of the downsides of Drag Race is that people show up there, like you're saying, and they are like, oh, Snatch Game, what the hell am I going to do? Oh, I got to act. This is stupid. I'm a drag queen. I shouldn't have to act. It's like, what is, they're forgetting the
history. Have you been watching?
Right. And they're forgetting that, you know, that the, yes, you have to have a vocation. You know, you have to, if you're going to be a famous or quote unquote famous, if you're going to be a working drag queen, you have to have
a queen of note.
Yeah, no. You can't, you know, people aren't going to come up and just stare at your makeup. Like that's not,
yeah, and and we're getting to that point, and I think this kind of came through Aja's first time around, is like, right, we're in the age of the look queen because of social media. Like you can get a following for being a drag queen and you don't really have to go out and do anything,
right?
That we saw this with, I mean, yeah,
they can certainly turn that in, and some of them have. Some of them have become makeup artists, and they're doing makeup for other queens. That certainly is a vocation and a talent. I mean, I get lost watching videos of people doing their makeup because it's really fascinating, especially with drag, because you're, you know, building a new face. Not everybody has that talent, just like not everybody can paint a painting and it make it really look real. And like, so that is absolutely an art form and has its place within drag. So I don't want to be completely dismissive, but I'm just saying at the end of the day, if you're going to go on Drag Race and you want to tour the world in a show, have a show, you know, have something to put on and something to do.
Exactly. Yes.
All right. So yes, that's our Drag Race hour. I was going to ask you, so I can't remember, we were talking, you and LeJimmykins have a Switch or not? Nintendo Switch?
Oh, I thought you meant like a Switch, like a person who is a top and a bottom. No, we have, we don't have, well, I don't video game.
Okay.
G-A-Y-M-E.
Of course.
James does, he does like, he has like real gamer games. Like he has an Xbox and plays things with like a headset and talking to other people occasionally.
Which but, you can do with the Switch. The whole point is it can be both. It's a console and something to carry around.
I also didn't know that, but like I I grew up with like an NES system. So I like the very basic games. So I'm like a Mario. I'm like, you know, anything with like when the Wii came out, I was really excited because I'm like, oh my God, we can do like virtual tennis or whatever. So I mean, I'm not opposed to like eventually getting like a Switch and stuff because I do like playing, like I like Smash Brothers, I like Mario, I like Mario Party. But I'm not like a super, like I'm not a first person shooter game person.
Right.
Unless it's House of the Dead in an arcade, and then I'm all about it.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I'm kind of the same. We did get one. That was part of the, you know, the holiday. We got one. And I've been really enjoying it because I'm the same. Like, and it has like a whole, because we have like the account or whatever for it, the Switch Online, Nintendo Switch Online account. And so you can download these packs as part of the subscription, as part of the membership that have the classic NES games. So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
Playing like Super Mario Brothers, and I'm terrible at it. I cannot, you know, because I panic. That's the problem why I've never really been into video games, is because I'm holding the controller and I panic and I just start pressing all the buttons. And so I run into walls and I jump off things and I end up running into the monsters or the things that are, you know, jump that you're supposed to be killing, you know, running into my own, you know, things. And we've been playing Mario Kart online with friends, which is super fun because we kind of do like a group conference call and then everybody just, you know, talks shit and, you know, plays Mario Kart. And that's actually been really fun, but I'm also terrible at that. I'm always running off the track and I throw a shell and run into it myself.
I'm so bad at Mario Kart. Because it's like, I actually was so bad at Mario Kart as a kid that I was like really worried to like start to learn how to drive.
Oh, right.
Because like driving games, like I just can't get the hang of it. But I do love, like, one of my favorite things is to play like the mini games in Mario Party with like a bunch of people.
Yeah, we've been thinking about getting Mario Party. Everybody keeps saying, because it's so funny, we're like the last of the little group, because you know some of these people, but they've had Switch for a long time. And so we're like these nerds on there, like, want to play Mario Kart? And they're like, we're over Mario Kart. Can you get Mario, whatever, what was it, Party?
Mario Party,
get instead, or get this game instead. It's like, oh my God, we just dropped an insane amount of money buying the console, the games. We bought some extra controllers and, you know, an accessories pack of other cool stuff. I actually bought for the Switch, they make the classic NES controller because it's just
easier
for me to use.
You know, the little rectangle with the red buttons.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm like, that's enough right now. So I can't go buying all these, you know, $60 games.
You can play Mario Party remotely with people? Oh, that changes some things for me.
You can get on, because we do that with, like, they're all in their houses, and it's just online. So they create a tournament, and we race cars, and I guess it must be the same. I don't know. I've not played Mario Party with anybody. It's been solely Mario Kart. And that have an online component where somebody can create like a room basically, and we all log into it with a code, and then you just race each other or battle. We did a battle one where you just drive around hitting people with things like bumper cars in a way with weapons, which I'm also terrible at. I'm terrible at all of it, but that's not the point. The point is to have a good time.
Yeah, you're having fun, and that's great.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, because I play it, and by myself, I'm like, wow, I win. I do really good, but it's just me. It's not as fun, you know. Because I try to practice, you know, to play it. Mm-hmm.
You're gonna get so many like requests to like be added on the Switch or whatever. have you done that, like, what's that, the game, that pandemic game that people love with the islands and
Animal Crossing?
Yeah.
It does not. That does not sound entertaining or fun to me. And after listening to people on my particular chat that we have for like months complaining about it, I'm just like, this game does not sound fun. You know, will somebody come to my island and give me this thing? I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. But I mean, again, if you get something out of it, people, wonderful for you. But it does not sound entertaining to me.
Okay.
But you know, people love it, obviously. And they play. It sounds like boosted Farmville, and I just don't understand.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I just it. Yeah, so I'm not as.
Oh God, and I played Farmville. And then after a while, I was like, you know, if I don't care about actual, like, if I'm not an actual farmer, I'm not going to be a virtual farmer.
I mean, I remember it was all the rage. And of course, you know, you jump on and look at it. And I think I only did like two crops and then I abandoned it. I just don't have the patience, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and those sorts of games. And I think in the end, a lot of video gaming is about patience. Like, I remember when friends were really into World of Warcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, I just spent 8 hours running around doing this, 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 and this, you know, just building up something. I'm like, you spent 8 hours doing that in a row? It just sounds tedious, you know? And
yeah.
Animal Crossing sounds similar. It's tedious. And unless you have a lot of friends or a lot of people that are all helping each other, like real life, it just doesn't, you know.
Well, have I said on this podcast
together.
Have I said that I've been doing Pokemon Go? Right, I've said that on this show. So I've been.
I think you have, but maybe not.
So Legitimikins is like has been playing Pokemon Go from the get, and I did it for like the first like 3 weeks in 2016. And what I love about it is that like it is, what I've always loved about it from like an quote unquote intellectual standpoint is the idea that it's a virtual community that also meets in real life, because a lot of times with video games, you congregate, you gather, and you do things in the virtual space. Whereas with Pokemon Go, it's the augmented reality space where like you actually have to go to the place and do this in order to get something. So
right.
I've always thought that was really interesting and a way for people to be brought together. That being said, you know, I really was like looking for some sort of diversion in like October, November. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to jump back on my Pokemon Go thing. And now like I was at level 15 and I'm at like level 32 because it really is just have like very like commitment, but also like low stakes commitment. Like I don't have to, you know, there's the patience aspect of it, but like, you know, oh, you catch the Pokemon, you don't catch the Pokemon, you do this, you do that. And it's very, very low stakes in my mind, but like, I'm also experiencing like now I'm like hooked. So, you know, I thought that first taste and now I'm hooked, but
yeah, I would definitely not say I'm hooked. I do like when the stars align and our friends can play, but I'm not necessarily running to play, you know, anything just on my own. I mean, once I had to play a few days just to figure out how to work the controls, but I don't care if I lose or whatever. And you know, it is just the fun aspect of kind of playing with people. You know, and kind of seeing myself like improve playing it, you know, building those motor skills literally with Mario Kart in the game. But you know, it's easy to like cards or something where you're kind of, you know, just chatting
yeah.
and playing a pretty straightforward, you know, game. So yeah, that's our, we're not sponsored by Nintendo, but if they want to give us some money for, kind of half-assedly selling Nintendo Switches.
I mean, I may, honestly, Joshua, I may get a Nintendo Switch if only just to play one game of Mario Kart with you. I think that would be super hilarious. And if then we'll just have
to, like, a game, you'll win it against me. So don't worry.
I've played Mario Kart before. I've played Mario Kart in like an arcade with the full, like, you know, Dave and Buster style system.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
like yeah. And still not as good.
No, so. I can't do any of it. But it's super fun. So it was kind of one of those things. I realized on our last episode, kind of talking about the holidays, we didn't really talk about much of the holiday of, like, you know, things that we had received.
Yes. What was your favorite thing you received? Compassion?
Yes, compassion is always welcome. I'm really enjoying the NES. I thought that was a really good good gift in the end. Jeffrey also got me a stack of these Ferrero Rocher chocolates.
Oh.
And they have the dark chocolate ones in them, which I thoroughly enjoy.
Oh, antioxidants. Good for you.
I think I posted on our Instagram account my little gifts, because I got a really cool book of bats, a really neat Pennywise statue, a really neat decanter set, which we're going to put absinthe in. It was pretty good. You know, like I said on Instagram, may everybody feel as understood by the people who love them. Because I got some creepy, weird gifts that I freaking love.
Nice. I am a gift card queen. I enjoy, and it's like, I always make it a point, like, you know, always make sure you buy at least one, like, you know, trivial thing, and not like because I'm a trivia person, but like, you know, one thing that's not practical with your gifts and stuff. But, you know, I did get, like, my mom gave me a Pokemon, like, not Lego, but like, you know, off-brand Lego, like, set. Oh, cool. It's like over 1,000 pieces. And I was like, you know what? I really, like, that was what I did in the days after Christmas, was just taking my mind off of screens, putting my phone away, and just doing that puzzle.
I like Legos.
Yeah, it's it,
to kind of sit and put them together.
Exactly. And I was like, you know what? I may start doing more of that as a way to just, you know, do something productive that doesn't require me to look at a screen. Right. I could also read too, but, you know, let's be real.
You did get some.
So yeah, it was a good time. Yeah, it was a good time.
Are you wearing a Fright School t-shirt right now? I love that.
I am wearing a Fright School t-shirt underneath.
Perfect. We can just plug that as well on our TeePublic. If you look at our link tree, we have some cool designs. Valentine's Day is coming up. And what better gift for the person you love in your life than an I Heart Fright School shirt?
Yeah, like an I Heart Fright School shirt. Are you caught up on Chaos? Are you caught up on Chilling Adventures of Sabrina? No,
we haven't even started the new season. So,
okay.
The last one was like every bit of True Blood they could siphon off and put into one season. That's what it felt like. It was like we got demigods, like, you know, pagan kind of thing, very Maenad, you know, when Marianne was on. We got things in hell. We got stuff going on with heaven. We're going back to the Nazarene. We're going to, you know, Pilate and all this stuff. Like, it was just the Loch Ness monsters, time egg or whatever. It was, I'm just like, what is happening? There is so much going on in this show. But we're trying. We're going to start the new season soon. And then we'll get caught up on that, Joe. I promise.
And then I finished it and I need to talk about it because I just need to talk about it. And I remember picking it back up. I picked it back up like around Halloween. And then I realized, like, oh, well, I'm just going to keep going because the new season's coming out soon. So,
We just finished the third season a few days ago, or part three, however, you know, they do that. So we're going to start the new one soon. I promise.
If part three is True Blood, part four gave me a lot of Buffy vibes.
All right. Well, there we go.
A lot of monster of the week type thing. So,
okay, cool. Well, we'll see. We're going to start it soon. So we will definitely talk about that when we do. Otherwise, I think that is it. We've managed to, I was like, let's make this quick. And again, we have filled up a half hour of rambling. So we are going to take a quick break and we will be back to discuss 2013's The Purge. Also yesterday. No.
Meanwhile, in New Jersey.
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and, the practical effects. And also the male gaze.
My gaze at the males.
Hi-oh! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
All right, welcome back. So, yes, welcome to our first in our Purge series. We're going to be covering, this is just going to cover the films. I do know there's a whole television series, which is also interesting. And I did enjoy watching, but we're going to focus just on the first four films. So today we're going to start with 2013's The Purge, starring Ethan Hawke, Lena, is it Hedy? Lena Headey, Adelaide Kane, Max Burkholder. And they are kind of members. It's sort of interesting because Ethan Hawke plays the father character here who sells security systems specifically to keep people safe during the Purge. And so they're a very wealthy family, obviously, because people have bought lots of these systems. And that does form a crux of one of the conflicts in the film. But so they're a wealthy family that society, you know, they don't engage in the Purge in the sense that they, you know, don't go out killing people, but they support it. And they're just kind of hunkering down for the night thinking that they're going to be safe. And, you know, as usual, all hell breaks loose. Dear Joe, what did you think of sitting down and watching the Purge?
I enjoyed it. It gave me a lot of like quarantine vibes.
Ah, okay.
Like the movie Quarantine. I like how it was, a lot of it was in the dark and like flashlights and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so, and also I was just, it was not what I was expecting. In terms of like, because, you know, I mean, more recently seeing trailers for the other three Purge films, like it seems like they went in a completely different direction after this first Purge movie. So it's interesting to kind of see it like play out in one family story. But yeah, like I really don't, I enjoyed it. And I was thinking like, okay, this is one of those movies that's like not so much horror. Like you could sell this to somebody. I was mainly thinking about like, would my parents enjoy this? Because, you know, they do enjoy like action-y fare. And I was like, oh, they could enjoy this. I mean, like there's the psychological elements, of course, of like, you know, one night where all crime, including murder, is legal. But yeah, I mean, overall, I thought it was also really interesting, and I enjoyed it, but it was not what I was expecting. Like, I was expecting it to be more like what I saw the trailers for the more recent films and not necessarily this kind of like a kind of take on the home invasion trope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. That's sort of like it's a dystopian sort of conversation, home invasion conversation. You know, yeah, there's a few different things that they're sort of playing with in it. What I really like about the first movie is I like being kind of dropped into something where there's not really explanation. You know, you're just dropped in and you're accepting that this is the world that these people occupy. You know, there isn't a ton of like subtext to what the Purge is, how it came about, you know, not really. I mean, you know, there's conversation of the new founding fathers and, you know, there's hints at it, but that's all explored later. So I really, I like that idea. You're just sort of dropped in. Mm-hmm. And I think in the timeline, what I found is, this film, the Purge, I keep wanting to call it The First Purge, but that's the title of something. So the original Purge, The Purge, is set the fifth year of the national rollout, somewhere around March of 2022.
Okay.
And so...
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, because the first Purge is, I think, ideally it's like 2014, something like that. Right? No. Whatever it is. Anyway, because they have like a test before it becomes a national. So this is one that's been nationally recognized. It's been around for a couple of, you know, for a few years and people are fully in support of it. And then the later films kind of jump another 20 some years in the future or something like that. So yeah, I just think I like that plot device, you know, of dropping us just in to into what is happening. And then, you know, there's obviously lots of foreshadowing in the first few minutes with the tense conversations that Lena's mm-hmm. character, Mary. So it's James Sandin, Mary Sandin, and then their kids, Charlie and Zoe. So kind of what I wanted to start talking about with The Purge is sort of like the concept of it, you know, of The Purge. And historically, we have this idea of like carnivals, you know, like in religion, like religious celebrations, you know, where you have those times where all bets are off and like society kind of gets upturned, or, you know, before a time of like withholding, like Lent or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of idea of like Saturnalia, which was this ancient Roman festival, which I think is interesting, typically held on 17th December, which is my birthday, of the Julian calendar, and then later expanded through the December 23rd. So it's interesting at this time of like holidays.
Yeah, they co-opted. Yeah.
Right. Festivities of that.
Early Christian church, you know, gets the way you convert the pagan. This is how my humanities professor worded it. It's like, well, how do you get someone to, you know, how do you get the people from the old religion to buy into the new religion? Well, like, give them something that was outlawed from, because Saturnalia was outlawed in Rome for a while, but then the Christian church adopted it and basically turned it into Christmas and gave them what they gave them something that the other one took away.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Very that. you know, so kind of this this idea of having this time where things like gambling are permitted, or, you know, at the time the people who were enslaved were given the same sorts of freedoms, even, you know, reversing the social order and giving opportunities for people to just celebrate without limits, and then kind of coming, you know, back to this time of being limited, you know, so these sort of once a year having that complete and utter. You know, and we see that obviously, you know, especially in the fall holidays and the winter holidays, you know, where we suspend work and everybody's kind of free to do, you know, to be with family and to celebrate and merry make. And we all eat to excess and we drink to excess and, you know, we celebrate, you know, so some of this idea still kind of holds space. You know, mm-hmm. Although we do have several times of the year where we, you know, kind of let loose. But just as the idea of, like, you know, having celebrations that are like overtly suspending societal rules, being overly sexual, overly violent, you know, that this dates way back. And then when I was thinking about, like, yeah, like religious purging, you know, carnivals, Saturnalia, I also was thinking about sort of more recently in like dystopian fiction, how it kind of feeds into The Purge. Things like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, I think it's sort of like an early, or not like super early, but, you know, fairly early and very controversial when that came out, because the idea of like a small town of like good people stoning a woman to death after, you know, making a choice, and they do this once a year to cleanse, to you know, whatever it might be. Maybe it had, I think in the story it's like started with like, you know, the crops, you know, make sure the crops grow, so we do this human sacrifice. Again, a very old human idea of human sacrifice to appease gods, to appease the crops, to appease, you know, the weather, whatever. We can find all sorts of reasons to murder each other for the good of everybody.
Exactly. There's two, you just named two movies right there, Wicker Man and Ready or Not, which was a recent movie. It came out in 2018, I believe.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it kind of feeds then into larger concepts of, like, you know, we every single day we're told that murder is okay if it protects democracy, if it protects some sort of loose idea of, you know, that sort of a cerebral concept, you know, mm-hmm. and I like this because the writers, this is like the Purge symbolism and representation from this hyper real simulation blog. It says that the writers of the Purge deliberately named the ruling political organization in its universe, the New Founding Fathers, because one of the founding fathers said something similar. Thomas Jefferson said once that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And so, you know, this idea that, you know, if you're a good patriot, if you're a good citizen in the Purge, you will allow the Purge to happen. You will engage in it. You will, you know, take out your grievances for the year, purge, you know, the anger, purge the hatred, purge this violent side of yourself, and live in relative utopian society for, you know, the other part of the year. And so within the Purge, they say that, you know, having it for 12 hours, it goes 12 hours each year, has led to the United States to be virtually crime-free and unemployment rate has dropped to 1%. So again, this idea that now obviously other things kind of play into that, which we'll get into discussing in the later part or the later part of this series, about, you know, making the wrong connections, you know, as we do mm-hmm. all the time, you know, with as we go along as good citizens, voting for war, voting for certain things to happen without the follow through of the full consequences of it, of who it really affects. And so I just like the idea of, you know, being they have these overlords that are like, kill people for peace, which is not too far from our everyday lives. So again, the Purge is extremely topical, always, at least for the last several centuries.
Yeah.
Which kind of feeds a little bit into my next point that I found in discussing within the symbolism of the Purge is the Stranger. So that's the character who is being hunted and the young son lets him in.
Edwin Hodge, I think.
Yeah, is that what his... because I feel like... yeah, that's the
actor's name.
But they call him... And what's funny, this says Bloody Stranger, but the Stranger. And I found it interesting because so this... especially in talking about the Purge as sort of a conversation about government-sanctioned violence mm-hmm. in the real world. So this website I found is called A Neighbor's Choice. Now, I don't highly recommend this website in the sense that there's a lot. It's overtly very Judeo-Christian, and it's kind of looking at the Purge as like, if these people would get Jesus, then they wouldn't, you know, then that would save mm-hmm. society. And so I'm always kind of wary. But I thought that it made some really interesting points. Because first of all, like, how can enlightened and secular society adhere to such a barbaric norm? You know, so if we've made society better, wouldn't it truly be even better if we didn't murder people every day? Like, mm-hmm. how do we allow, like... You know, how do we allow violence and destruction that we know can be remedied in other ways? But mm-hmm. it kind of continues on. So I thought that was a very good thought, you know, to think about within the terms within the Purge. So I also like this because so looking just at the Stranger, and he's kind of operating as a couple of different symbols here for people. So hold on 1 second. I'm just trying to find exactly where it is. So to a leftist watching the Purge, this victim may be any non-white person who is, you know, the victim of society's ills, for however mm-hmm. you want to define. To the conservative person, the victim may be the serviceman who has sacrificed himself for the nation's freedom. And so what here, his veteran status, cause there's like a scene, you know, where he's wearing the dog tags and he's,
yeah, the dog tags are very prominent. Yeah. And I was like, okay, we get it. There's you know, there's the symbolism of those dog tags. They're just very prominent the entire time, every time you see him.
Yeah, so they say here, his veteran status symbolizes the individual who is utilized as a pawn in the mass sacrificial machine by authorities. The filmmaker's depiction of the black man's failure to instill mercy into the white father is an attempt to paint a racial narrative to the scapegoating mechanism, which I think is... they kind of go here a little bit deeper into that. Failure to unite against scapegoats unanimously is the very reason the Day of Purging exists, both in the movie and in reality. Current events show us what a desperate and reckless search for scapegoats leads to, namely rioting, looting, and the indiscriminate killing of more innocent people. So I think where they're kind of going with that is politics, society, communication, as we... well, no, is extremely complicated. And there are not easy answers. There's not easy black and white, bad, good, evil, good, you know. But because we, in order to keep things where they are, like status quo, we have easier answers are kind of put out, you know. So like this. The Purge is saying we're going to kill people once a year to solve society's problems. Don't think about anything bigger than that. Don't think about, especially in the later films, which again, we'll talk about when we get there, how the poor are and people of color are more affected, you know, and then maybe there are reasons why the Purge is successful that have nothing to do with the Purge itself, with the idea of what the Purge is doing. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of liked, like I said,
which is kind of brought up in the newscast, like it's kind of brought up in the background of the 2013 film, of the film we're discussing today.
Yes. Yeah. A little bit. There are definitely, again, things that are tucked in, you know, that are further explored, I think, as it goes on. But I thought that was sort of an interesting kind of thing about talking again about war and about, you know, military violence and how, you know, we scapegoat, you know, we send, you know, this idea of like, you know, poor working class people to a country to kill other poor working class people to uphold this vision of our leaders, you know, and that's kind of like the Purge is operating like that here, you know, where you have this, you know, the streets become a war zone for 12 hours and people kind of hunt each other down and do whatever they want in order to execute this idea that the bourgeois and the ruling class have about how society should be run and about how we fix society through more violence and more bloodshed. Rather than we could invest that $700 billion or whatever the hell it is, you know, in homelessness and in, you know, healthcare and in other ways to improve. So, you know, the Purge is extremely dystopian. It sets itself that these people are now living in a utopian society. And again, that kind of echoes what I was saying a little earlier. I don't think I mentioned yet Brave New World in 1984. Because they're kind of similar in that society is extremely fucked up, but everybody's kind of either under the impression that things are okay because in Brave New World, they're given a drug to suppress everything, or in 1984, where the government operates as if it's doing good things, but everything, it's like doublespeak. Everything is the opposite of what it actually...
Yeah. It's two sides to the same coin. It's either like complete authoritarianism, or it's like you've subdued... you've basically subdued everybody because you've subdued them with their own pleasure. Like it's you're either being restrictive or you're giving them everything. You're unrestrictive. So, but it's two sides of the same coin because it all leads as a form of, it's all a form of control.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I just think it's, again, I thought that was a very interesting point about looking at, you know, both how the left and the right might read The Purge and see it differently, seeing either, you know, this wealthy class hunting this black man down to purge and to feel good, and that being state sanctioned violence, which again is not fiction. You know, we see that every day with the police, you know, the militarized police caste. I don't know exactly how to, you know, because you have like the working class at the bottom. Then you have like the watchdogs for the wealthy elites that keep us separated. And so the police play a role in that. The military play a role in that, and how the state chooses to exercise that violence, you know, affects the working class differently than it does wealthy class. And then even above that, the truly ultra wealthy that are making, you know, that are extremely powerful, making political decisions and influencing society, war, you know, I mean, they're the ones investing mm-hmm. in all sides of everything, and then they always win. Meanwhile, we're out killing each other in the streets because we're starving and we're sick and we're over it. And nobody knows where to put the real, you know, it's no accident that within the Purge series, the political class, the politicians are protected and you can't kill them, even though they're the ones in control of making these decisions. And they're the ones who, again, we'll get to discussing more with election year, what happens when they, you know, as we saw with the Capitol, bring it up a little bit with what happened there, what happens when they're actually threatened, you know, mm-hmm. what happens when they have to actually deal with the consequences of their actions. But at least within the original Purge film, that is not a concern. You know, they've successfully created this situation and people have gone along with it. Something else I thought about, just a really tiny bit of trivia is of symbolism, is the flower that's in it. So it's the Baptisia australis, known as blue wild indigo or blue false indigo, which I think is interesting. It's a the flowers that they buy to show that they support the Purge.
Support the Purge.
Not going to engage in it. So it is used by what I found was, so the Cherokees would use it as a source of blue dye if they couldn't get a hold of indigo. And it's the roots of it are used in teas as a purgative, which I thought was kind of cool. So it has a direct association. And the Osage would make an eyewash of it, which I thought was also kind of an interesting analysis. So the thing, so they're using these flowers, which symbolize purging to some extent, but also the seeds are known to be toxic, which I also thought was interesting. So it's like
interesting
overall, this plant, which is known as being a false, you know, the false indigo plant, it's a purgative and its seeds are toxic. I thought was kind of a nice little, it's not an accident, you know, they didn't just pick some blue flower to be like, you know, it's, I think it's very specific. And I thought that was a cool little trivia bit I found in researching some of this. Mm-hmm.
Can I tell you my most the most disturbing part of the whole film for me?
Yeah.
Handsome stranger's little speech to the family. That was the most terrifying part, where he's like, you know, smiling blonde preppy dude is like, you know, calling him, what is it, the filthy swine, like, just like what he called him, like completely dehumanized him, but like, you know, very happy about it. And then just like the way that the intimidation, he was able to intimidate them. Like in, you know, it's like, I see with your flowers that you support us, but you know, like we will purge and we will use him to purge. And it was just like, ooh, interesting.
Yeah. And they're functioning sort of as like, you know, this idea, like false patriots, you know, in a way, like,
yes,
that, mm-hmm. like, is this really, you know, they are fully indulging in this violence and in this, you know, act. And it's like, is this really, you know, but they're just reveling it. They're having fun. He's a fucking psychopath, you know.
Very Manson, like very Manson-y with like, you know, the women in the flowy gowns and, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah, no, it is. It's super creepy when they show up. And so they're the people who were hunting, you know, the stranger, Edwin Hodges' character, and the son lets him in to give him safe harbor, and they want their purge. They want him to come back. So I thought, yeah, I think that's an interesting, it's a nice plot device. So you're not because when you first watch it, you kind of think like he gets in and then that's going to be the conflict, you know, with like, is he going to kill them? Are they going to kill him? Like, you know, the tension there, obviously the daughter's boyfriend shows up and shoots the father or shoots at the father. That's the whole, conflict. And then they show up and add this whole, like a whole other level of conversation of they're showing up. They're the good patriots. They're the good people that are just exercising their rights, you know, that are just exercising their right to murder or rape or steal or what, all the different crimes that are covered by, this 12-hour period.
Yeah.
So, which kind of leads us to the last, point that I wanted to talk about, which is the psychology of the purge and whether or not such a thing, if the foundational conceit of the purge is something supported by psychologists. And so and what I found was it kind of depends. So I was looking at a look at the psychology behind the movie The Purge. This is by Dr. Carolyn Kaufman, writing for Psychology Today. Again, kind of have to be, you know, grain of salt. Psychology Today is very entertaining, obviously. So even writing something like this, you know, it's just kind of should, you know, take it with a, you know, not exactly a grain of salt. But, you know, she is a doctor talking about... The purge suggests that aggressively venting our rage is a kind of solution. And so I really liked how she, and this will be in our notes so you can read this yourself because it is very interesting. When we, hold on 1 second. Let me find what it is. Basically, her main point is that people... When allowed to be violent, it only makes us more violent. That aggressively carrying out this sort of violence would likely make us more violent and might likely make us more, you know, because that's one of the questions, kind of like in Gremlins, when is midnight over? Why should a person stop at the 12 hours? You know, I mean, I know that there's risk of public execution, but you're carrying that around. It, like, if we're, you know, a family and somebody comes in and murders one of us that, you know, that's a, you know, somebody that you're going to see out in the world. How do you live with that for a full year, plotting and planning? And then you're just simmering with rage and with this violence all year, you know? So if it seems like this should not, it wouldn't work psychologically, at least with, Americans or, you know, with, Western society.
Yeah,
I think it's sort of the main kind of point. If rage begets rage, both in ourselves and in others, it might sound funny to say this, but I think that a film like 28 Days Later, in which zombies are violent because they're infected with a rage virus, has a more realistic understanding of all of this than The Purge's reduced social problems. You know, researchers have found that sometimes retaliation against the person who upset us can help calm us down, but only under circumstances. If they direct their counterattack toward the provoker, if their retaliation seems justifiable, and if their target is not intimidating. So angry people aren't usually angry about one single problem or person, you know. So the general thing, you know, when we're going about in our lives, traffic is upsetting, you know, we take that in, we're angry for those moments. We have a, you know, an issue with a coworker, you know, it's not really the coworker's fault. We're in a bureaucracy. There are problems that happen. So we're angry about that. Our, you know, our partners upset us, our family members upset us, our kids upset us. You know, there's lots of different things that feed into anger that don't have a specific, you know, attack. So if it can't be blamed on one person, then somebody like that person's not available to attack. There isn't one thing to attack. So when we have no specific to rage against, attempts to achieve catharsis can actually make us feel more helpless, which just fans the flames. Psychologist Roy Baumeister argues that most evil acts of cruelty and violence are actually due to an escalating competition over who did the other person most wrong. So if you do something that I don't like and I attack you and then you go, well, fuck you, and you attack me and I go, well, fuck you, and I attack you back, then we just sort of escalate, and that there's not a catharsis there. Mm-hmm. There's not a place to end that. I also found this interesting there, you know, the idea of a type A personality, which this says that most people don't realize that that moniker was originally coined to describe coronary patients. So type A personalities are more likely to develop coronary heart disease. So because they are...
That's interesting.
Because they are likely to be competitive, impatient, interpersonally hostile, and angry, they've established this causal link. I think that's a little dangerous again. That's why, you know, to say causal, but a correlation... That mm-hmm. people who live the type A life are more likely to develop coronary heart disease. So angry people are stressed out people, and chronic stress is associated with a bunch of other problems. So none of this is to say that anger does not serve a worthwhile purpose if it alerts us that someone is mistreating us or that we have issues that need to be dealt with. But beating the stuffing out of a punching bag, let alone another human being, is likely to make us more aggressive, not less. That's kind of her overall point.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, she goes on to just talk a little bit about, you know, just solutions instead, but we're not interested in that, right? You know, what could we do instead of the purge? Well, that's no fun.
Yeah.
Therapy. So as a counter to that,
wealth distribution,
right? Exactly. Like real actual solutions to, you know, people that have to live in such dire consequence or dire straits, you know, dire circumstances, is to give them the resources not to have to live that way. And then maybe society would start to improve. But, you know, don't be silly, Joe. That's socialism. So there's this interesting. So I found this paper that analyzes this. It's called Fighting on Christmas, Brawling as Self-Governance in rural Peru. Have you heard of this? Takanakwe?
I have not. I have not, but I do have some, there is something not necessarily similar, but like the Saturday before Easter Sunday, there is like a, in the Chamorro culture, there's like a belief that like, it's called Glory Saturday or Sablon Gloria. And basically you like spank children for their sins before the resurrection. All the sins they committed.
Do you know how far back that tradition goes?
No, it was always something that, it was always something that was brought up on Glory Saturday by my parents, and apparently it happened to them, but I don't know how far that back that goes, and if it can be traced to, if it was a gift from the colonizers or if it's something that we kind of came up with, but that'd be interesting.
I wonder, because I think that kind of feeds into what this paper is kind of talking about. So, there's this public brawling ritual, Takanakwe. I'm just butchering all of this, I'm sure, Chumbivilcas province of southern Peru. So, and the idea is they have this ritual, which again, it's so funny, it happens around the holidays when, mm-hmm. you know, around Christmas, on, you know, in our calendar and in our idea of, you know, this time of year, you know, where people get together to resolve their conflicts and create a peaceful society by having it out, by brawling, mm-hmm. by punching each other, by... having a violent episode once a year with the people who have wronged you.
Mm-hmm.
And so this paper, they actually tried to do an institutional analysis of it and come to a conclusion of whether ritualized violence provides an effective mechanism to solve conflicts. The result is, you know, an efficient, unique method to resolve disputes in rural communities without access to or trust in formal conflict resolution methods and a device like at a judicial level or some more disputes that a justice system would not deal with, you know, just petty things or you know, just the things that, you know, maybe throughout the year we get is, I'm sick of your fucking face, you know, like, I can't get justice for that. So I'm all punch it. And then we're going to hug, we're going to shake hands, we're going to move on. And that's sort of the idea. So what they found was that their study, they think that it is an effective mechanism for this particular group of people, and that it is an organized environment with public sanction and strict rules to avoid excessive physical harm. So we're not talking about, you know, super violence, not murder, but just a mean to resolve conflict that a corruptible formal judicial government would not, you know, find satisfactory to see. And it says here that there's been attempts to change this, to take away, and they refuse, you know, that this is even pushed away because it's an effective mechanism to resolve conflict.
Yeah.
And that they, you know, once they go through this, you know, everybody kind of like, they do seem to live in a relative peaceful existence with each other. And that this, because of it's a traditional thing that's been around for a very, very long time. And so the people in this organization, you know, this village, this place, believe in it. They follow the rules, they have respect for its history, and so it works for them. And so I think in applying that to the idea of the purge, like, that's not something that we could just have happen on, you know, a wide scale. You know, I don't think it would function the way I agree with the psychologist who in a society where we already are extremely dysfunctional in a lot of ways. I do believe that the purge would make us worse, not better. Even if it was not as an extreme, even if it was literally like, you know,
you could slap your neighbor with an open hand.
Right. But yeah. That in the end, that would fester more problems than cure them. But for this group, because they have had this for centuries, I'm assuming it does seem, you know, again, there isn't, admittedly, not great research. This is a pretty well researched paper. They also recognize that we're limited, that we only have, you know, this, you know, evidence that we studied. And you know, but that it's a historical thing for this group of people that they have respect for, and that's why it works, and that they really can set aside their differences and kind of move on. And in order, and we can't, you know, figure out how to, you know, pay for a road without wanting to kill each other, you know, so it might be that we're already too far gone for something like the purge to actually work.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds a little similar to, the like dueling among nobility, the dueling practices among nobility, where it's like it is on the fringe, but it's a way for people to reestablish quote unquote honor in a structured way.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I just thought that I was looking for things to talk about. Yeah, whether or not, like, could the purge work? And I was thinking about some other stuff, like the Matrix series. Mm-hmm. So the computer system, or the machines, tried to give us utopia. Is the conceit in the film that it tried to make our lives perfect, and we could not function within their fictional environment. And that was something like, you know, Jeffrey and I were talking about first. It's like, can humans really exist in a state of pure happiness without some sort of violence? Like, is that even possible? You know, is that something we can accept? You know, are we by nature? I mean, this is just, you know, again, this is a rhetorical kind of question that, you know, the purge sort of brings up in the way that, like, the conceit of the film is we have made the world wonderful and perfect, well, the United States, because once a year we let y'all have it out and murder each other and do whatever you want. And we don't care because we're protected. The new founding fathers are protected. You can't purge us. So do whatever you want. And that has led to this. So it does beg the question again in this film, like, life is utopia, but this is not utopia, you know, yeah. Especially if you're not wealthy, if you don't have access to this kind of security system, which again isn't impenetrable. Obviously they do break into it with a, it's not a tank, it's some kind of truck. They rip the
doors and the windows off.
But it's reasonable enough that they...
He's also able to cut the electricity.
Yes. You know, so obviously there's, like, workarounds, and that's what makes it a horror film. And, bring, you know, I mean, if that wasn't possible, then, you know,
yeah.
You don't have a conflict.
Which, you should be, like,
yelling at each other for 12 hours.
Which, like, you know, Mary is telling him, like, but we're safe, right? And he's like, well, I mean, you know, not everything can be kept out. And it's like, dude, you... Our livelihood, your entire business is on the idea of security. Like, he wasn't selling security so much as a deterrent. Like, it was just, you know, I see the steel things come down, which means, like, you know, okay, probably we're not going to be able to get in, but, you know.
Right. Yeah. The illusion of security.
The illusion of security. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we have a lot in society, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
There are lots of kind of rules we're all abiding by out of mm-hmm. Either a sense of respect for our fellow man or a sense of fear retaliation, you know, or imprisonment or whatever keeps people from committing violent murder all the time.
And like you bring up an interesting point about like just like the idea that like, you know, you can have it out, but then like it's the resentment afterwards, like once you've done it, if both people survive. And so like that's what I was thinking about at the end of the film, yeah. Which again, spoiler alert, it's just but you know, the end of the film, you realize that like the neighbors were ready. It, you know, right. The neighbors saved them, but it's a false thing. They're actually going to purge them because of the resentment of like, you made all this money off of us. I just don't want to see you anymore. And so, and then like, you know, it's like, okay, she's just like, we're not going to kill anybody. We're just going to ride the night out. And then it's like, okay, well now those neighbors are going to have to like, you're going to have to live next to them presumably live next to them if you're not going to move, but like, you know, live next to them for the next 364 days until the next purge when they're going to try again to get you.
Right. And that is the, you know, again, the problem, like I said, like the gremlins conundrum of like, what is after midnight? Like, don't feed them after midnight. Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, what do you do with that? You know, except mm-hmm. plot and plan for a year and be angry and hateful. And, you know, I'm not talking to her because I'm going to murder her on the next purge, you know. You have to live in constant fear then, you know? And so that's why, yeah, the kind of the ideology behind it doesn't really work. And they're going to make another sequel is coming out soon called The Forever Purge, which deals with exactly that. Like what happens when a group goes, fuck the 12 hours. Why? Doesn't make sense. You know, we should purge all year round, you know, and be free of these social constraints. I imagine, I mean, there's been a very little revealed about it, but I think that is the possibility of what they could explore. And that is one of the kind of my fundamental questions about, you know, I'm not saying The Purge again, like I said, we're not trying to review and say whether it's a great film or not, but I think it brings up a lot of interesting questions about the psychology of violence, social psychology, you know, how do we manage to operate? As bad as things are and as horrifying as things are, a lot of us are able to operate fairly normally. You know, mm-hmm. at least get up and go to work every day knowing that, you know, there's a ton of things perpetrated by our tax dollars or, you know, the horrors that happen every day to keep life where it is. Mm-hmm. You know, this balloon we're all sitting on waiting to pop. I think it brings up a lot of interesting and overall the whole series. I'm looking forward to kind of continuing this discussion next week and in the following week, because I think there is a lot being said and a lot that is extremely relevant to now. So I think that's a good place to stop, at least with this conversation. Like I said, this is going to kind of stretch over the next couple of weeks. I hope you enjoyed the film to some extent.
I'm already getting ready for the future because I have all the movies queued up. Awesome. I probably will get them all done in the next couple of days. So it'll be nice
to kind of just watch them all when they're on. I just tend to binge them.
You binge the purge.
Binging. There's something there. There's a title there for the episode. I'm glad. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. And yeah, this is something we've never really done, was do a kind of a full series examination. We've obviously done sequels and things like that, but I think it accidentally became extremely topical to look at this.
Yes.
More so than it was topical already. I mean, they were topical.
Yeah, it was already pretty topical, but now it's like definitely more so topical now.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is, yes, part one of our Purge analysis. So thank you for listening. As always, dear listener, share us with your friends. like us on Instagram. I'm going to try to, one of the other gifts I got Jeffrey, I don't know if you watched The Mandalorian, but we got one of the child.
So James and I, one of the ways that we keep connected in this age of distancing is we watch a show together.
Yeah.
And so our next show, we said that the next show that we're going to start is The Mandalorian.
Oh, cool. Well, I can't wait to hear what you think about it. But I got my little Sam Squanch, a statue. It's like a full scale replica
of the child.
Cute. Yes, it's super cute and weird. Super weird.
Is it in his office?
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of stares at you from the hallway.
Oh, God. Yeah. It looks like it could be related to the gremlins, your little gremlins.
Yeah, a little bit. The cats totally ignored it. They're like, what the fuck is that? Oh, it's not living, whatever. And they just kind of wandered away.
It's not paying its attention.
No, exactly. It wouldn't pet them. But yeah, so again, thank you, as always, for listening. Like, rate, subscribe, all of those things. Joe, until next time.
Until next time.
Sleep well.
Good purge.
'Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davy Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
'Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California. Ha 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 ha!